Number 4. Railway Bridge. My granddad loved the railways and would bring me up here. He always wanted to be a loco driver, he said. To be at the head of the train, thundering along the tracks. And he'd become totally caught up in his own world as he explained it all to me. How you'd get one of those big iron beasts to hurtle along these tracks that carved their way through the landscape and changed the world. He made me promise that I'd never forget how to do it, to get a steam engine moving, just as he told me, over and over again. Not that he ever drove one himself. He was an electrician at the pit. But he spent all his spare time with his model trains, weaving around his garage. And he made me copy all the actions that he showed me, because he said you had to learn things with your body, as much as your mind. That once your body learnt things, you could never forget them, and they'd stay with you till the day you died. And that if a steam train did ever appear down there, out of the mist, like a ghost ship crashed on the rocks, and people gathered round it and wondered what to do, that I'd be the one who would climb aboard and rescue it, to get it moving, to set it free. He said he'd die a happy man if this line was active again, whatever kind of train they put on it. But you can stand here and wait all day and not see a thing down there, unless they're doing some testing, because that's all this line is used for. Every politician says they want to bring it back into use for passenger transport, to bring the trains back to Ollerton. They have their photo taken and talk about high-level meetings and 10-year plans and visions for the future. But we still have to catch the bus if we haven't got a car and we need to get anywhere. So nobody believes them anymore. My granddad made an Ollerton station for his model railway with tiny flowers hanging in tiny baskets and a tiny little me holding the hand of a tiny little him. And when he died, and we couldn't have a proper funeral because of COVID, I came up here and told him that I remembered everything he taught me. How the fireman would fill the boiler, shoveling coal into the firebox. How the reverser bar had to be pushed forward, squeezing the release handle and easing it into place. Opening the cylinder cocks, turning the front headlight on, and blowing the about-to-move-forward whistle. 2 short blasts. Releasing the engine brakes and opening the throttle. Not too much. Keeping an eye on the cylinder cock exhaust and closing it when the steam begins to flow. Moving the reverser bar slowly back towards vertical. "And away we go, Sophie," he'd say. "You've done it. We've done it." Out in the open air, the firemen building up steam as faster and faster and faster we run. All the signalmen waving at us. Horses neighing as they gallop alongside. Couples out on their bicycles, throwing their hats in the air. White clouds of glorious steam billowing into the sky. The sun bouncing off the burnished brass. And nothing to stop us moving on and on forever. And there she goes, under the bridge and off into the distance. And my granddad, driving her now on his own. Heading off to wherever you head off when it's all over. We should keep going. Not towards the chalets, but through that stile on the left-hand side of the road we just walked up, keeping the railway track to our right. At some point, just after you've seen a track, heading off to the left towards an industrial-looking building, this path will bend round to the right and will split into two. Keep to the left. Otherwise, you'll end up crossing the track and heading off up to the Pitwoods, which is worth a visit, but not today. At the end of the path, you'll see some green railings in front of you, on either side as we come out onto a circular road, Darwin Drive. It's a fair walk, so let's have another one of the stories. The second one. It's called Bloody Bobby Healy, and a name that some of you may remember. And this one is set in the 40s. I'll remind you of the directions again when it's finished. And if you think you might be arriving where I've told you and the story is still playing, then just hang fire for a bit and let it finish.
Bloody Bobby Healy. He caught me again and I was for the long jump all right, I can tell you that for nothing. It was bloody mad though. Lawns you can't walk on. Especially when the men had money docked out the wages to pay for the upkeep of the things. I couldn't believe it when Bobby Healy first turned up at the house and explained that the front lawns, all of them, were ornamental and not to be walked on in any way. And as punishment for my terrible crime, he told my father that he would normally have had more money docked out of his wages and his name recorded on a notice board at the bottom of the pit headstocks. But then again, he boomed at us, seeing as you've been doing so well for the team, Jim, I think we can overlook it this time. Bobby Healy had the right to go into any property to check that it wasn't unclean or overcrowded. And my God, if there were any signs of anybody playing away, then the company would send in the heavies. Just ask the woman who left her husband to move in with another miner. Not only was that bad enough, but the man she left played the cornet in the colliery band. How could she possibly walk out on one of our most faithful servants? She must be evil to the very core of her rotten being, and had to, of course, be evicted. I think Bobby Healy liked me, though. I wasn't a tearaway or anything. I used to fetch the fish and chips from Pope's for the teachers at Winnie Lane on a Friday. And I did a paper round, through Wellow. And the most important was that he had high hopes of me developing as a footballer, certain that I'd follow in my father's footsteps. He was brought over from Staffs, my dad, because of his skills as a centre-forward. That's how it worked. Monty Wright, the manager of the colliery, was a keen sportsman, and the colliery company wanted to beat all the other collieries in absolutely everything, football and cricket and bowls, as well as anything else they could compete in, like silver bands and choirs. So the company had scouts. If there's a player on the opposition who'd skinned your right back, then the next day, sure as eggs is eggs, Bobby Healy would be on his way to offer him a job at the pit with a decent house. And it happened to us. One Saturday afternoon, my dad was picking up his boots and heading out the door for a game of football. And the next minute, I was sitting between him and my mum on the back of a cart with all our belongings to move into a three-bedroomed house better than anything we'd ever seen before. Because sport in this place was, and is, almost as important as coal. And you couldn't believe how many top-notch people there are running round. Every night you've got people training in one sport or another. And when I was younger it was even more so, with men sparring at the gymnasium, being massaged with winter greens and olive oil in a big bottle, or pulling on the rope and weights at the old welfare as part of the tug-of-war team that never lost to anybody until the day they were cheated out the British Championships. And they were eight blokes you wouldn't want to meet on a dark night. They could hold up the whole bloody coalface between them. If the company wanted prestige, then they had it all right. With teams winning trophies and being coached by ex-England internationals. And hundreds of people turning up for home games. And supporters clubs driving to away games. Not that they showed much allegiance when they couldn't use you anymore. There was a married man from Staffs, a footballer, Percy Washington. He got killed in the pit. And after his death, his wife was turned out of the property. So when my dad broke his leg, we were all a little bit worried. My mother came up to me and said, "You better start behaving now, because your dad's reputation isn't going to help you." And I was a bit upset, because I wasn't a bad lad. It was just that every now and again I found myself walking on those lawns. "Can't you get it into your thick head?" my father would shout at me. "They're ornamental, got it? Ornabloodymental!" And they weren't too happy about the fact I was knocking about with Frankie, whose father drank like a fish, played the piano, and was often to be found in the middle of the night, lying all over the ornamental lawns. My dad must have known he'd never be the same player again after his injury, because he started getting on at me to play more and more sport. And Bobby Healy kept popping round to ask, "How's the leg, Jim?" And then one day he said, "I saw your son play last night on the rec. Could turn into a useful player. You make sure he doesn't waste his talents." Well, that was that. I don't know what Bobby Healy had seen, because there were loads more better than me. But Dad took it as a sign. or a threat. And from then on, he had me training every night. No more mucking about with Frankie. I tried, I did, but I couldn't play. It was as simple as that. In my first game for the juniors, I gave away two needless penalties and nearly cost us the match with the most overweighted back pass the game of football must have ever seen. The goalkeeper almost broke his wrist trying to stop the thing going in. And as usual, my father was stood on the sideline shouting encouragement and putting his face into his hands. And to make it worse, Frankie turned out to be a natural sportsman without any training at all. And it wasn't just football. He could run like the wind, drive a ball through the covers like swatting a fly, and bowl a googly that could google itself. When the gala day was held at Ollerton Sports Ground, Frankie would walk round the village, looking in all the shop windows where the prizes were displayed for all sorts of events, and he'd tell me which ones he was going to win. And he was normally right. Bobby Healy realised. Everybody did. If my talent wasn't showing now, it never would. "It's a face that will never be uncovered, and that's that," he said. And he stopped coming round. Until that day when I was caught on the lawns one more time. I'll tell you this. I never did it again. And I've never had an ornament in my house. And I never will until the day I bloody well die.
I hope you enjoyed that. So, at the end of this path, you'll see some green railings in front of you on either side as we come out onto a circular road, Darwin Drive. Cross over that, go through a similar set of railings on the other side of the road and keep going straight along the path. You'll see some new houses to your right, and there's a good chance there'll be a caravan or a motorhome on one of the driveways. Follow the path round to your left, with the flats looking down on you from behind the fence, and you'll come into a very interesting playground. If you do get lost, just ask someone where the skate park is, because that's part of where we're headed. It's on the way to Tesco's, so I'm sure you'll find it. When you get there, find a place to sit and go to the next track.